This is the Takeaway Weekender podcast, and what we've got for you this week are two really remarkable and extended looks at the idea of America's authentic identity. The voice and sound of America, if you strip out the commercial glitz and sidestep the obvious influences from other countries, which is a hard sidestep to do because this is a nation of people from somewhere else, either by choice or by someone else's choice. Take the South. It embodies that tension. Americans here by choice, and the Americans here because they were slaves. Symbols of the South have been re-examined this month in the Confederate flag debates around the country and in the re-examination of the literary classic To Kill a Mockingbird in light of Harper Lee's just-published Go Set a Watchman, a very different story. In the case of the South, as complicated as it has always been, it is always the most recognizable of American identities.
John, when I think of the South, I see a quilt, a beautiful, multicolored patchwork image.
That's Bill Ferris, professor of history at the University of North Carolina. Ferris has been making that quilt for years out of history, out of images, and out of the sounds that define the South. This is how he thinks of this complicated place he knows so well.
I find myself falling back on those voices and the people that I've been privileged to meet along the way.
I'm influenced in whatever I say by the fact that I innately love the South.
The famous and the not so famous.
The man says why I sing the blues is because I lived it.
The B.B. Kings, the Eudora Welties.
I was brought up in a good household because we always had books and we always believed in learning.
The prison inmates.
Well, the high sheriff. Uh-huh.
The mule traders. Auctioneers. They're all part of the common picture.
Ferris is the senior associate director of the Center for the Study of the American South and the former chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. We've had many thoughts of the South recently, with the Confederate flag controversy, even the echoes of the South of the 1950s in that Go Set a Watchman, the new Harper Lee novel that's not really new. Those voices and echoes of a past that stays with us. Sounds that ring, Bill Ferris says, like the bells in a clock tower, marking out the passing years.
Well, I grew up on a farm in rural Mississippi. My family were the only white family. The other families were black. And as a young child at the age of five, a lady who worked for our family named Mary Gordon would take me to the church, Rose Hill Church, near our home, and I learned the hymns and became a part of that community in a way that really shaped my life and inspired me to become a folklorist. And when I was five, I went to the first grade, a little schoolhouse where each teacher taught two classes. And my black friends went to a little schoolhouse on the farm where one teacher taught six classes. Mm. And I resented that, and I asked my parents why my friends and I could not study together. And they said, that's just the way it is. And I never learned to accept that. I always felt it was wrong, and my love for those families and for their worlds within that church and worlds that we shared from the time I first remember inspired me to have a life as a folklorist that would honor their memory, their voices, their music, and their history as a part of my own.
Can you evoke for me what it was like to be in that Rose Hill Church in Vicksburg?
It was powerful. The dramatic voice of Reverend Isaac Thomas and the power of the a cappella hymns, the Dr. Watts hymns sung by the congregation, are memories that I can never forget.
Yes, and I saw Jesus, that Lamb of God, who took the cross of Calvary and carried it to the hill. Yes, sir, and he dug a hole 3 foot deep and hit on a solid rock and nailed it to the cross.
They really transformed me. It was all the human voice. And the whole fabric of what I do as a folklorist began in that little church and on that farm.
Well, one drum will make up a dying bed. One drum, I say one drum, will make your enemies. I'll let you alone. One drop will raise up a bow down head.
It seemed to me that the black church and the voice of Reverend King were all speaking from the heart about a morality and a religion that dealt with injustice and that responded, as we've seen in Charleston. The voices of that church were unbelievably powerful, and they really touched the heart. And that church really set the standard for what I expect religion to do, and all too often it fails.
Tell me a little bit about this voice that you recorded in 1968 in Clarksdale, Mississippi.
Now, what I mean about hidden violence is this. If you own a farm is working, the man you go to work, you work there a little while, he treats you fair. But older you get on a job, he may cuss you out and dog you a little bit. You're afraid to come out and tell your friends, or you're afraid to speak about it. He take part of your ointment. You're afraid to ask him about it, because you know perhaps you get killed.
There is a latent violence within this society, and it often rises in an unexpected and frightening way to force people to act in certain ways. And there is a long history from slavery through the civil rights movement through Charleston, South Carolina, in which violence comes to the face of experience in a devastating and awful way. And Southerners, especially this speaker, live with that awareness and are always wary of life because of what he calls hidden violence.
And hidden violence is a narrative in so many Southern writers. Here's author Alice Walker speaking with you in 1989.
When you think of Southern writers, you really think of white Southern writers. I mean, that's what most people think of. I don't really have any interest in sort of integrating Southern writers, you know? On the other hand, how can I possibly ever not be considered a Southern writer since I'm a Southerner and since I write?
For Southern black writers, the complicated relationship to the South is especially powerful, and this is why we see so many Southern black writers lived their literary careers as expatriates. Richard Wright fled the South and lived in Chicago, New York, and finally Paris. Alice Walker lives and writes in her home in Berkeley, California, where she wrote The Color Purple. So they still have deep roots in the South and write about it.
Well, the high sheriff told the deputy, want you to go out and bring me Lalo.
Why is it that in the South there might be so much intolerance for people who end up in prisons and penitentiaries, but there's a recognition that within those walls, a culture will out. There will be singing. There will be storytelling. And that's recognized, even if the people who are in there are victims of intolerance.
It's true. The prison world is a kind of incubator for music and for voices and stories. And we can see some of the greatest music albums, B.B. King's Live at Cook County Jail and Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues were recorded in the prisons because country music and blues is sung about those worlds, and many of the songs are set within prisons.
Well, the house, yeah, told that, will I come out here to arrest you?
So the prison is a kind of powerful, high-intensity place where songs like the prison work chants are indescribably beautiful and also deeply sad.
Fast forward to 100 years from now, what do you think the divide between South, North, East, West will be in America? How will the South distinguish itself?
Well, if the past is any measure of the future, and I think it is, the South will always be different. It's a different region. There will be a lot more Hispanic, Asian. It'll be a much more diverse population. But there will still be a sense of place, a sense of history, and hopefully the old terrible history of racial violence will have been put to rest. We thought it had been laid to rest in the 60s, but it still haunts us today. But I think, I hope in the deepest way that with the events in Charleston, we have turned a corner, and we've seen the president in his incredibly moving address breaking into song.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.
Touching us in ways that Reverend King touched us. And those voices will help give us direction for the future. Hopefully in the coming years, there will be a new South in which, as Reverend King dreamed, black and white will hold hands and play together and share in the deepest way, which is the American dream.
Well, you're one of the voices and sounds of the South, Bill Ferris. Thanks so much for talking with us.
It's an honor to be with you, John.
Bill Ferris is professor of history at the University of North Carolina, the senior associate director of the Center for the Study of the American South, and the former chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. You can find a collection of Bill's recordings in his books, The Storied South and Give My Poor Heart Ease, and now online at the Southern Folklife Collection, where the Ferris Collection, containing thousands of his recordings, was digitized just this past week. We've had some nice moments this week thinking about the sounds of the American South. And here's another one. The Allman Brothers Band doing Statesboro Blues back in 1971. A distinctive, unmistakable American sound. So when guitarist and singer-songwriter Warren Haynes was asked to join the most famous Southern rock band of all time a quarter century ago, he knew it was a big responsibility. It was like stepping into history. And Haynes says maybe that's why it wasn't really so hard. Southern musical history is something that's inside him.
Spots of time flash before my eyes like ribbons of light. Helplessly I try to touch them before they disappear.
This is Haynes in our studio playing a song from his new album, Ashes and Dust. The song is called Spots of Time. The album is the latest step in a journey to find and keep an American musical sound, a journey that Haynes has taken with the band Government Mule, and on this album, with the band Railroad Earth. In Ashes and Dust, he gets back to the beginnings of a long career.
It's mostly taking some of my earliest influences of folk music and Appalachian music, which I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina. That music was everywhere. And I studied that music and was mentored by some folk musicians and singer-songwriters and bluegrass musicians that helped educate a different side of me than a lot of people are familiar with. So these songs are songs, some are brand new, some are quite old, but songs that I've accumulated through the years that never seemed like Allman Brothers songs or Government Mule songs would not have fit into my last solo record. This is really a record I've wanted to make for a long time, and it's the most personal record I've ever made.
Personal in what sense?
The songs are about time periods or relationships that are the most important in my life. It's like a collection of memories, and so the song Spots of Time that I played is kind of indicative of that. It's about this heaviness of looking back at your life and all the things that have happened, that when the dust settles and you look at all the things that are the most important and what you've held on to and what you've let go of. And every song on this record in some way represents that sort of either time-specific era or personal relationship.
From your perspective, what is the difference between music and the music business? From your perspective,
hopefully, music is just something that intends no harm to anyone, anytime. Music business, I'm not so sure. I've been very fortunate because somehow just doing what I like to do and making decisions based on just what I think works for me has, in the long run, paid off. I've never had to second guess myself, try to figure out what the marketplace is looking for, what other people might think. One of the problems I think with the current state of affairs in music and in the music business especially is that people are too willing to compromise too soon. And we all suffer because of that, because the bar for art goes down when artists are too willing to compromise. Mm.
And everybody gets confronted, you know, with the compromises that also are dressed up as opportunities, that sort of thing. When you look at a band like Government Mule, are they like the band in a sense that they're a group of musicians looking for an authentic American sound? In the band's case, they were hugely successful. I mean, Government Mule, not so much, but certainly not unsuccessful. Are you on the same path?
I think so, yeah. I think we were just blending our influences together in a way that pleased us and that we felt was an organic kind of mixture of influences. In the beginning, since Government Mule started as a side project to the Allman Brothers, and myself and Alan Woody were full-time members of the Allman Brothers, we were just doing Government Mule for fun, so we didn't really have any aspirations on it being successful, on doing a second record, a fifth record, a tenth record, any of that sort of stuff. We were just kind of taking one little step at a time. And maybe that's one of the reasons that it lasted 20 years is because we weren't expecting more than we should, I guess. And as quite a surprise, we became successful. And you know, our current business model is so different from the old days. Now we allow people to download the shows and download the music from every show we've done since 2004. Mm. And we've sold almost 3 million songs download of live performance, which is kind of uncanny and in some ways unprecedented, especially for a band that's based on radio play and mainstream commercial success, because the reason it works for us is because we do a different show every night, a different set list every night, so people are interested in what we played tonight and the night before and the night before that, as opposed to some bands that just play the same songs every night the same way. No one is interested in seeing how that changes.
Interesting thoughts in music today about identity. Grateful Dead, they kind of don't exist, but their identity is really, really strong. What do you make of what's going on with the Grateful Dead this summer?
Well, I'm really glad that they chose to do something for the 50th anniversary, because I think the fans really wanted that. And I'm sure most would have liked to seen more, but to get the five shows that they got was very important. The reason that music is still an entity this long after Jerry Garcia passed away is because the timeless nature of it. There are a lot of eras of music that get a resurgence for a little while because the people that listened back then are a certain age now, and they're looking to have or create that insurgence. But there are other types of music that once they get reestablished as being timeless, they stay timeless. And I think the Grateful Dead qualify for that. The Allman Brothers qualified for that. And I can speak that way because I'm not an original member. I was a huge fan of the band. But when I joined the Allman Brothers in 89, they had been broken up for 9 years and had questioned not only whether or not they would ever get back together, but whether they would ever achieve validity again. Then they saw the Grateful Dead doing really well on one side. They saw Stevie Ray Vaughan and Robert Cray and music like that doing well on that side. And they thought, hey, somewhere in between those two things is what we are. They reformed for their 20th anniversary. And then people deemed them or deemed their music timeless from that point forward. And so I think it'll be around forever.
What do you make of the blendings that have taken place in our time that would have been unimaginable maybe, 20, 30 years ago? I mean, I think there's an interest in hip-hop blending with country, and some of that seems very sort of commercially calculated, but some of it's legit.
I think the legit stuff is cool, and the commercially calculated stuff is terrible. I think if something happens organically because the people creating it have an equal amount of love and respect for two different genres, that's really cool. But when people say, you know, if we mix this with that, we'd reach a lot more people, I think that's what's lowered the bar extremely for music. And an example being what you said, country and hip-hop. I think when they started mixing pop and heavy metal, that was the beginning of me being really turned off by it because I think they just kind of ruined both at that point. Yeah. Not that I'm a huge fan of either one, but I don't, you know, what made metal unique was the anti-pop nature of it.
Right.
And when you start applying like heavy production stadium snare drum sounds and guitar sounds to melodic pop music, I some people would say, oh, you're just closed-minded. No, I don't think so. I think I'm not open to things being so manufactured and calculated just to make money.
Disney should not do the Ramones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I agree totally with that.
So what do you think of, because in some ways, a lot of the really successful people in the music business, you know, talk a good game about authenticity and art, but they also talk a good game about wanting to make a lot of money and stuff. And so someone like Kanye West, I can't figure him out. Where do you come down on Kanye West? Some of the music is fabulous.
I don't know that much.
The personality thing is just sort of...
I don't know that much about Kanye's music, and I definitely don't know enough to give an informed opinion, but my opinion is that history will be kinder to Miles Davis and Bob Marley and Muddy Waters and Otis Redding and Ray Charles and James Brown. Let's leave it at that.
What about Taylor Swift?
I don't like to say anything negative about anyone, and I'm not informed enough about their music to know. I read the strangest quote from her, and I'm not sure why I'm even sharing this, but I saw this quote where she said, "I'm always thinking three award shows in advance."
Oh my God.
And I just thought that is the strangest thing you could possibly say.
But that kind of says it all.
You know, I've never thought of an award show in my entire career.
Yeah. How big is the guitar for you?
You know, I guess not as big as some people would imagine, because I started singing before I started playing guitar. Mm. I was dabbling in poetry as a young kid, and as soon as I picked up guitar, that turned into writing song lyrics, and I've always placed equal emphasis on singing, songwriting, and guitar playing. So my influences are coming from three different directions, or at least three different directions, and I'm not always listening to guitar music. I think I'm, in some ways, maybe I listen more like a fan than some musicians because of my love for songwriting and singing and playing. I'm not someone that thinks you have to listen to your own instrument all the time. I think I'd probably listen more to singers and to tenor sax players and stuff like that, you know.
So the guitar is just your accompaniment.
I love it. Someone asked me what I was trying to sound like with my guitar, and I said, like Sonny Rollins's saxophone.
Nice.
And to me, that's the epitome of a great tone. So the closest I can get to that with my guitar, and I always threaten to retire one of these days and learn how to play the sax, but I'm sure I never will.
You know, I bought one a long time ago. You know, one of these, like, used saxes. It was a great decision.
Yeah.
I mean, I clear the room whenever I pick this son of a bitch.
I like that scene in Moscow on the Hudson.
Yeah, but it's so fun. I mean, everything what they say about the sax is true.
Yeah.
The voice is there. It's the most organic instrument. It's the most intimate instrument. It's unbelievable.
After the human voice, which is the greatest instrument of all. Yeah. And that's the thing that I love, is that any instrumentalist that sounds like they're singing through their instrument, that's what moves me.
Yeah. Song lyric you most admire, just a twist, turn, a fragment, just something that, like, you loved.
Of someone else's?
Anybody. Just anything. I mean, there's something about a song lyric that's just like no other.
Well, today, you know, there's so many, so I'll just go with what was in my head this morning when I woke up. Masters of War.
You might say I'm unlearned, but there's one thing I know. I'm younger than you.
Even Jesus would never forgive what you did. When I think about those early Dylan songs and that one in particular, it just reiterates to me the fact that people don't have to compromise and say what they think people want to hear. Mm-hmm. And that goes for musically, not just lyrically, but there's golden eras in jazz, there's golden eras in blues, rock and roll music, folk music, and if you look at any of those time periods, they're usually around 10 years long. People were just making the best of their current situation, combining their influences and expressing themselves to their utmost ability before the genre figured out, what if we did this, we could make more money, and what if we did that, we could reach more people.
Do you think part of the next few years for you would be the possibility of getting a call to be in another one of these big jam band kind of, you know, Grateful Dead kind of,
I don't know,
monster shows of the summer?
I don't know. I mean, I've been so fortunate in the way that I've played with so many people and worked with so many people that I grew up listening to. I never predicted that my career or my life would go that way. I always figured, you know, I would, just like most people, you do your own music and see what happens. But when I joined the Allman Brothers in 1989, I inherited this audience that I didn't have the day before, and gradually earned the respect of that audience. But also had to think of my own music and how that audience would react to what I was doing. And I guess that's one of the, not downside, but one of the considerations when you join an institution is, where do you fit into that? And I never expected to be in the Allman Brothers, and I never expected to tour with the guys in the Dead. they're experiences that I wouldn't trade for anything. And if something like that came up out of the blue that I could never predict, I can't say whether it would be the right thing to do or not. But I know that being able to express myself in so many different ways, especially from a songwriting perspective, and is one of the most important things for me, because I love so many different types of music. I'd hate to be pigeonholed or trapped doing the same thing all the time.
Well, you're carrying a lot of Americana around with you, and it certainly comes out in this album. Are we still looking for the American sound?
I think so. You know, you mentioned the band earlier, and in some ways, even though it's much more acoustic than even most of the band stuff, this record, Ashes and Dust, of mine, kind of reminds me of some of the band stuff in a way that it's modernizing folk music and taking timeless topics and timely topics and applying them lyrically to the music that you're doing. When the band came out, all the British bands were so floored by that, because they had a handle on American music that had to be inherent and had to be part of nature. And
no, you look at the band, it was like those songs, you wrote them, or it was like the band.
Or did you discover them in a time
capsule?
They
came out of
somewhere.
A chest coming somewhere. Yeah. That was something.
Yeah. It still is.
Yeah.
Like, I think that music, my love for that music is even more than it was back then.
Yeah.
And I've always loved it, but it's one of the few, things, musically speaking, that is better now. It gets better with age, and that's such a cliche thing to say, but it's true.
Well, I think you do as well.
Well, thank you. That's the whole point, I think, is to get better with age, but
yeah.
We don't always do it.
Warren Haynes, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The joys and memories of a lifetime playing, singing, and composing American music. Warren Haynes joins the Authentic American Voices in music, writing, and speaking. Also images. What did Woody Guthrie say? Diamond deserts, Blue Ridge Mountains, endless skyway, Golden Valley. Give us your choice for authentic American sound or image or passage of writing, anything. Be a folklorist for us by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE and join us during the week on The Takeaway, live on public radio or on The Takeaway podcast.